Okay, we'll hear first from the defense.
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman. May it please the court. My name is Captain Scott Martin, and together with my co-counsel, Captain Heather Tregel, I represent the appellant in this case, Sergeant First Class Julu Caldwell. Sergeant Caldwell was convicted after the panel was instructed to use a negligence standard to determine whether he was guilty of maltreatment. The panel was not tasked to consider what Sergeant First Class Caldwell knew or thought with respect to his actions. Although Article 93 is silent as to mens rea, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the absence of mens rea in a statute does not mean that none exists. This basic principle of statutory construction was most recently reaffirmed in Alanis, where the Supreme Court reiterated the basic principle that wrongdoing must be conscious to be criminal, and held that negligence is insufficient to show the required consciousness of criminality.
What are we supposed to make of the part of the instruction that the military judge gave where he said that the treatment, that maltreatment referred to treatment when viewed objectively under all circumstances is abusive or otherwise unwarranted, unjustified, and unnecessary for any lawful purpose?
Your Honor, that's precisely the type of instruction that the court took issue with in Alanis. It asked the fact finder to look at the facts of the case, the totality of the circumstances, and then decide whether or not a reasonable person or an objective observer would find that conduct wrongful.
But what about the phrase unnecessary for any lawful purpose, which indicates that it has to be unlawful?
Your Honor, I think that goes to the concern in maltreatment that does not capture hard duties that could be assigned in the military or other treatment that somebody might not like but may be necessary to their military duties. But whether or not his actions were unlawful does not tell us anything about what he thought with respect to those actions.
Aren't we worried here as to whether or not they was instructed that the conduct was unlawful or wrongful?
Well, fundamentally, Your Honor, the fact finder was required to determine that Sergeant Caldwell knew his conduct was wrongful. We're not saying that Sergeant Caldwell needed to know that Article 93 existed. This isn't a mistake of law defense, but he did need to know the facts that made his conduct criminal. And those facts in this case are that his conduct was abusive and that it was likely or reasonably likely to result in mental or physical harm. Rather than having the panel determine whether objectively his behavior met that criteria, the panel should have been instructed to determine whether Sergeant Caldwell knew his behavior met that criteria.
Counsel, everybody in all the briefs seems to presume that this is a plain error case. Why is this a plain error case? Why isn't this waived? A military judge said, here's the instruction. You got any objection? Defense counsel says, I have an objection on an unrelated matter, but not on the rest of it. Bang. Why isn't it waived?
Your Honor, I think it's fairly well established that error is plain, and it's plain at the time of appeal. This case was tried back in 2014. Alanis was decided in June of 2015. So the error here becomes plain and obvious after June 1st, 2015, when the court issued its decision in Alanis, and that's why.
So it's purely the fortuity that Alanis came along later.
Your Honor, I wouldn't necessarily call it a fortuity. I mean, certainly we would be in a different circumstance here if Sergeant Caldwell had exhausted his direct appeals. But nevertheless, it is.
Well, no, I'm not talking about whether he's exhausted his direct appeal or not. I'm talking about whether it was waived trial.
And again, Your Honor, I don't believe it is. I believe the error is plain on appeal. There was a comment in Justice Alito's concurrence that Alanis had waived it because of the instruction he had requested. It wasn't exactly what the Supreme Court ended up holding, but the majority didn't agree with that either. So I would say that it's not waived because now it's plain at the time of appeal, Your Honor.
Counsel, have you and your colleagues done an analysis of all of the uniquely military offenses under the Uniform Code of Military Justice? In other words, this would be a very far-reaching decision if we held you had to have specific intent to violate a direct order of a commissioned officer. you had to have specific intent to do all these various things. Don't you judge these crimes by the conduct that person intends, the natural consequences of their conduct if they do intentional conduct?
Well, I don't believe that's what the Supreme Court held, Your Honor, in Alanis. What the Supreme Court said is that the scienter requirement, the presumption in favor of scienter, applies to every element that criminalizes otherwise lawful conduct. The only reason that Sergeant Caldwell's actions are illegal here is because they amount to maltreatment. Accordingly, the government was required to prove that he intended or knew his behavior to amount to maltreatment. But I think it's also very important to understand that Article 93 and 18 U.S.C. 875 are drafted differently. 18 U.S.C. 875 has two distinct elements, and where the government and defense disagreed was that both the government and the defense agreed that Alanis had to knowingly make a communication. Where they disagreed was to whether or not the government was required to prove that he knew the communication was a threat. Article 93 only has one element, and that element is that Sergeant Caldwell maltreated Specialist CH. So there's not even that potential for ambiguity about which element is the actus reus and which element the scienter must apply to, because there only is one element here. But even if it could be parsed out into two elements, the majority of in Alanis squarely rejected the government's argument and said that everything that criminalizes otherwise innocent conduct receives that presumption in favor of scienter.
Counsel, in terms of the instructions given by the military judge, he said, quote, "To find the accused guilty of these offenses, the accused conduct must have amounted to more than simple negligence." Why doesn't that cure the concerns the Supreme Court had in Alanis?
Your Honor, that instruction was given as part of a defensive accident instruction that applied to the 120 offenses. That did not apply to the Article 93 offense, Your Honor. I would just mention briefly that Alanis is a broad holding. In reaching its decision, the court cited several similar decisions covering a wide range of topics, from child pornography to unlawful firearms to food stamps to drug paraphernalia. And with this diverse range of topics as a backdrop, the court spoke in terms of its general approach to interpreting federal criminal laws. It spoke of basic principles and general rules, and it held that these principles are, and I quote, "as universal and persistent and mature systems of law as belief in the freedom of the human will." Nothing in the decision talks about the legislative history of 18 U.S.C. 875. Nothing in the decision talks about the history of threat jurisprudence generally. The broad nature of the holding is explicit, and nothing in that decision suggests that it would be limited to 18 U.S.C. 875. I think it's also worth noting that although they're obviously different statutes, in some ways they are quite similar. Both of them criminalize conduct not because it causes an actual harm, but because the conduct has the potential to cause harm. And in both cases, the fact finder was tasked with evaluating the wrongfulness of that conduct based on an objective standard without any regard to what the defendant or the accused knew or thought with respect to that behavior. Citing the circuit below, the Supreme Court rightfully acknowledged that is the definition of a negligence standard, because it removes from the equation the crucial question of what the defendant thought. And as the Supreme Court put it, what Alanis thinks does matter. And the same is true here. What Sergeant Caldwell thinks does matter. That's what this turns on, what he thought or knew about the nature of his conduct.
Would a recklessness standard be sufficient here?
Your Honor, I think that what Alanis tells us is that you need to take it on a case-by-case basis. There's not one mens rea that would be adequate for all statutes. What Alanis says is that in some cases a knowing standard, a knowledge standard, sufficient. In others, intent would be sufficient. And it gives a hypothetical of where even a specific intent would be sufficient. Because Article 93... in this case, and from what I see, is often used to capture expressive type conduct, statements, gestures, I think the court should exercise caution in applying a recklessness standard to something that might butt up against the First Amendment.
Dovetailing a little bit with what Judge Cox was talking about, there are a number of articles out there that don't address the issue of mens rea. your approach of each time we have to approach it differently, what type of guidance is that giving to the field about how to handle these cases, both in terms of trial counsel, in terms of military judges' instructions, in terms of the conduct of potential accused?
Your Honor, I can answer specifically for this case. The way maltreatment is currently defined is behavior that's abusive and reasonably could result in harm. So to apply a reckless standard here, I think, would create more confusion than it would resolve, because recklessness is traditionally understood as a substantial disregard for a risk. But what would it mean to substantially disregard a risk that something reasonably could happen? That reasonably could happen language and the definition of maltreatment, in my opinion, goes a long way to capturing what a reckless standard would capture as applied to an ordinary statute. To answer your question more broadly, Your Honor, I'm simply not prepared to say what the standard should be across the board for all military offenses, and I think the Supreme Court's rationale for that is quite sound. Depending on what the statute is, in some cases a reckless standard may suffice, and in some cases it may not. In this specific case, I would advise against it for the confusion with how that would interplay with the definition of maltreatment, as well as the fact that there are First Amendment concerns when you're dealing with the type of expressive activities that are often captured by Article 93.
Well, in this case, what's the lowest standard, from your view, that would be appropriate?
Knowledge, Your Honor. I think that Sergeant Caldwell, the government would have had to prove that Sergeant Caldwell knew that his actions were abusive and likely to result in mental or physical harm.
And what about wrongful? Would he have to know that the actions were wrongful, which appears to be what Ilanis was getting at?
Well, I think that's the very definition of wrongful, Your Honor, or in this case, that's what wrongful means. Wrongfulness means the conduct's not otherwise innocent, and making a comment that in one case could be flirtatious, in one case may be obnoxious, and in another case may be abusive and likely to result in harm, it's that latter case that's wrongful under Article 93, so that's what he had to have knowledge of. Once he knows that what he's doing is abusive, once he knows that it's likely to result in mental or physical harm, then he knows that what he's doing is wrongful, and the scienter requirement of Ilanis would be satisfied.
Why, when it's a military sort of offense, wouldn't reckless be enough? I mean, why, in your opinion, is its heightened standard required? I mean, for all the military offenses, why would it be anything more than reckless?
Your Honor, when you say a heightened standard,
knowing, you know, specific intent, knowing, I mean, that's a higher standard than reckless.
It is, Your Honor, and the Supreme Court held that knowing would suffice under 18 U.S.C. 875. They didn't answer the question of recklessness. They left it.
I'm not asking what the Supreme Court said in Lattis. I'm asking you why recklessness wouldn't be sufficient in this case.
And Your Honor, I think my answer, again, is that, A, because Article 93 captures expressive conduct, and we should be cautious about applying a recklessness standard.
Why shouldn't your client be cautious about the effect of his words on others?
Your Honor, that's a fair point. And if the government had proven that he knew that his conduct was abusive and likely to result in mental or physical harm, we wouldn't be here today. But they didn't prove that. And again, I think really in the context of Article 93, again, you have this definition of maltreatment that already includes language that reasonably could result in harm. So, again, when you combine that with recklessness, you're almost double-tapping the recklessness standard, a substantial risk that's disregarded that it reasonably could cause harm. If you knowingly do something that reasonably could cause harm, that captures what recklessness encompasses. So I think by combining the two, A, you're butting up against the First Amendment, which is concerning, and second, you're combining two definitions that don't necessarily mesh very well together.
Counsel, you're talking about being cautious when we're dealing with expressive conduct. But that's not the standard the Supreme Court gave us in Lonis. It's whatever mens rea is needed to separate wrongful conduct from innocent conduct. Can you give us examples of where, if recklessness was the standard, conduct that should be permitted would have occurred?
Your Honor,
could be criminalized?
In this case, I can't, and that's because I cannot imagine a circumstance where recklessness would capture something under Article 93 that knowledge wouldn't. And again, that's because the language in Article 93 of the definition of maltreatment, that a harm doesn't have to occur, only the reasonable likeliness of a harm. Recklessness is typically applied when you disregard a risk and then something bad does happen. Here we don't require that something bad happens, only the possibility that it happens or the risk that it happens. So I don't see recklessness interplaying well with the standard or the definition of maltreatment in this case.
So is your problem with the instructions or with the statute that they use the viewed objectively under all these circumstances, or that it doesn't specifically talk about recklessness or knowledge?
Your Honor, I don't think there's anything wrong with the objective standard. In fact, I think any time you're criminalizing expression, there does need to be some sort of objective standard. The problem here is that no regard was given to whether or not Sergeant Caldwell knew that his conduct was wrongful. I think appropriate instruction in this case would be something along the lines of, maltreatment means treatment that, when viewed objectively, meets the following criteria. And furthermore, in order to find Sergeant Caldwell guilty of maltreatment, you must find that he knew that his behavior amounted to maltreatment, as I have just defined it for you.
Counsel, we talked about plain error earlier. Now let's talk about prejudice. Where's prejudice here? Is there any chance at all that the outcome would have been different if an instruction you wanted had been given?
That's a question that requires a lengthy answer. I see I'm running out of time here.
Go ahead. Finish.
Yes, Your Honor. The prejudice here, although in the granted issue it was characterized as instructional error, really comes down to his ability to present a defense. If you were to affirm his conviction, you would be affirming that he did this knowingly, or at the very least recklessly. And that's not something that he had the opportunity to defend against. This court has said it will not do that. It adopted the Supreme Court's holding in Chiarella in Riley, saying that it will not affirm on an alternate theory. We certainly know that a court can't affirm a greater offense, and in many ways, knowledge versus negligence is a greater offense. But at the very least, it's a different theory. And under Riley and Chiarella, this court can't do it. I think a great example of that reasoning is this court's holding in Gaddis, where you may I continue, Your Honor?
Go ahead.
Where this court had a case where somebody had committed egregious sexual assault against a minor, against the daughter of a fellow service member, and in that case, the individual had been deprived of his opportunity to defend against the terminal elements of Article 134. And the government's position was essentially, how in the world could this not be prejudicial to good order and discipline? How in the world could this not be service discrediting? And what this court held was that when somebody is deprived of their right to present a defense, we are not going to speculate as to what that person could have or would have done, even if the defense is arguably
that's a different situation. That's a situation in which the statute says something. Statute doesn't say that here.
Counsel, you can respond on rebuttal.
Yeah.
And also on rebuttal, I'd like you to address, you earlier said that this statute has one element. Well, in fact, the statute has two elements, and the first element is that a certain person was subject to the orders of the accused. That brings in that unique military relationship where an individual is subject to military orders and places on the person who has the ability to make those orders a greater responsibility than we find in civilian life. And so what I'd like you to address is whether or not this aspect of military life and the fact that this individual is responsible to a certain degree for that, the person who is allegedly being maltreated, and that they're in a position of power that you're not finding, for instance, in Alanis and other cases, and how that relates to this case. And then you can continue on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now I hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Scott Goble, and along with Major John Choike, represent the United States. The military judge did not commit plain error by using the standard bench book instructions for maltreatment for two reasons. First, the military judge instructed using the objective standard long upheld by this court. And secondly, the validity of this established law was not altered or changed in any way by the holding in Alanis.
How about waiver?
Sorry, Your Honor?
How about waiver? Where does the government stand on the fact that this may have been waived?
Your Honor, this actually could have been waived because the defense didn't make an objection on it, as well as actually told the military judge that they had no objection to the instruction other than an unrelated objection.
But, counsel, isn't the law fairly well settled that when the law changes between the time of trial and the time of appeal so that, I mean, you'd agree that if he'd objected on the basis that there was no mens rea at the time of trial, he wouldn't have had a leg to stand on?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, he potentially could have had a leg to stand on.
Or you'd agree that Alana's change was a change. I mean, it gave him a clear leg to stand on.
It gave him a different leg to stand on.
Without conceding that he's right. I'm saying it gave him an argument that he didn't otherwise have.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
In that context, is it really fair to say it was waived?
And Your Honor, and that's why we've taken the approach and largely focused on the plain error analysis to be able to address the concern and the objection that he might have had it been at that time.
But I thought you said that one of the government's contentions is that Alanis didn't change anything.
It didn't, Your Honor.
And well, so then if it didn't change anything, he could have objected, and he could have objected, and he did.
Exactly.
You know, I understand Judge Ryan's argument, but if the government's position is that Alanis didn't change anything, then it seems like the government probably is arguing that it's waived.
Yes, Your Honor, this court absolutely could apply waiver.
Okay.
To this case.
Enough of waiver. Okay.
Because the standard and bench instructions are based on an interpretation of the current state of the law, a military judge shouldn't deviate from those unless he explains his reasons on the record. Considering this court's precedent under Article 93, there's no reason for the judge to do so in this case, especially considering the facts of the case. The military judge instructed that maltreatment refers to treatment when viewed objectively under all the circumstances, is abusive or otherwise unwarranted, unjustified, and unnecessary for any lawful purpose.
Okay, but counsel, how does that go to the mindset, the mens rea of the accused?
In this particular case, it didn't address necessarily the mindset of the accused, and that's because of the way general intent crimes have traditionally been approached in the military. The military hasn't separated out mental states in the same way as the Model Penal Code, with clearly identifying multiple mental states, but rather applied specific intent, which refers to premeditation, knowledge of a specific fact, or so forth, or general intent crimes. A general intent crime would require knowledge of the act, knowledge of the facts and circumstances surrounding the act, but not necessarily knowledge that the act would meet an end definition. So in this case, the appellant would have to have knowledge of what he was doing, knowledge of what he was saying, intentionally say and make the comments that he did, but he doesn't necessarily have to realize that would be maltreatment. In a case affirmed by this court, in United States versus Hansen, the Air Force looked at a case where an officer made repeated sexually offensive gestures and comments in his office. At trial, the officer made the defense that, I really thought these comments brought our office together, and so they served a legitimate purpose. In that case, the court said, it really didn't matter what the officer thought in that, because of the nature and purpose of maltreatment is to prevent an abuse of authority. So maltreatment occurs when the officer intentionally makes the comments, not necessarily that he intends to be abusive.
How do you distinguish what you're saying right now from the government's position in Alanis, which the Supreme Court didn't adopt?
Your Honor, even if this court does change it to where it applies the negligent standard, as the Supreme Court in Alanis, the nature and difference of this versus Alanis is the character of the military environment.
Do you have a view on what the difference is, if any, between a negligent standard and general intent?
Yes, Your Honor. It actually is tricky, and that's one thing the Supreme Court pointed out in U.S. versus Bailey, that it talked about the different mental states. And so the importance here is to focus on, did the accused intend his act? Not necessarily was the accused negligent in the fact that the act happened. For example, compared to an assault, where an individual may negligently be doing an act, but not intend necessarily to make contact. That's kind of where the negligence could suffice for the conduct, even though the conduct itself may have not been intentional. In this case, the negligence doesn't apply to whether or not these statements were made or the sexually offensive comments were made or the licking of the lips. The negligence would apply to, or the negligence in this case should apply to, was he negligent in those acts? And in this case, he wasn't. The military judge instructed in defining sexual harassment that sexual harassment could constitute maltreatment, and that sexual harassment included deliberate or repeated offensive gestures or comments. And so the instruction for the way in which sexual harassment applied showed and instructed the panel that such sexual harassment had to be deliberate or repeated offensive comments or gestures.
Counsel, in your brief, you seem to be focusing on distinguishing Alonis because the Supreme Court was interpreting a federal statute, and this is different. Now you're talking more about military character of the offense. Could you expand on that point a little bit more?
Yes, Your Honor. And so the Supreme Court in Parker versus Levy talked about that when interpreting military case law, you have to look at it in terms of the purpose of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and in terms of customs and courtesies and traditions of the military environment. As Chief Judge Erdman asked, the very nature of the superior-subordinate relationship makes this case different. And that is one thing this court has pointed out in Carson, as well as in the Carson's analysis, looking at some of the various case history from the time Article 93 was adopted to the code. And that is, the essence of this is abuse of authority. And so the military nature of this and the military conduct, our context, is that the individual to have maltreatment must be subject to orders. And that puts the appellant in a higher position of responsibility than you may find in Alanis. And so in a military-specific crime in particular, the purpose often will look to a lower standard to maintain good order and discipline. And so, for example, another example where this court has held negligence to be an appropriate standard would be dereliction of duty, that an individual could be negligently derelict in his duty, but yet still violate the offense under the code, that the individual wouldn't necessarily have to have the specific intent to violate his duty. And so when the court is assessing this, it should do so even if it applies Alanis or assumes that Alanis somehow changed the law. It should do so in light of the purpose of the UCMJ and within the context of the military. Considering the military-specific nature of Article 93, where the essence really of the crime is an abuse of authority, this court should not overrule its established objective standard. Accordingly, the military judge's instructions, when read as a whole, from the definition of maltreatment to the definition of sexual harassment, as applied to the facts of the case at hand, really shouldn't change. Even if it does, looking at the facts of this case would show any error complained of by the appellant would be harmless. In this case, the appellant never claimed, nor was his defense, that any of his conduct was innocent or could have been innocent. In fact, the appellant, his entire defense was the conduct never happened. When reviewing the closing argument from the defense counsel, he went through the credibility of the victim in this case and went through each of the statements for which the appellant was convicted of. One particular time was when the appellant walked into a CQ room, had looked over her shoulder and made some comments to her, and then made the comment of, "I could do things to make you fall in love with me," or words to that effect. The appellant's defense never was, "Well, I said it, but it was innocent." It simply was, "She is lying. She made it up." And so this court could find, no matter what mens rea was instructed on by the panel, it would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in this case, because the appellant's defense simply was, "It never happened," not that it happened with a different mens rea. Given the facts and circumstances in this case, show that the military judge's instructions were within the congressional intent and appropriate, and appropriately applied the objective standard set out by this court in United States versus Carson. Accordingly, this court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case, subject to this court's questions.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now have rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to make two points. First is that
if he had attempted to put on a defense of, I did it, but I didn't intend for this to be maltreatment, the prosecution, the trial counsel would have objected to relevance, and they in all likelihood it would have been sustained. And if his defense counsel had stood up on closing argument and said, look, my guy said it, but he did this because he was flirting or for some innocent reason, the next thing the trial counsel would have done was stand up on rebuttal, read the objective standard, and say, listen, panel members, it makes absolutely no difference what he knew or thought. It only matters whether you determined objectively that this amounts to maltreatment. And that's the very heart of cases like Chiarella, Dunn, and Riley. He did not have the opportunity to defend himself against knowingly, recklessly, or intentionally maltreating anybody. And if you affirm under that standard, you would be denying him of his opportunity to defend against that standard.
Do you think that Alanis stands to the proposition that general intent isn't enough?
Your Honor.
Do you think in any way, shape, or form that it supported to say that general intent offenses are no more?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. General intent.
Always been a general intent offense, right?
Yes, and general intent simply means intent to do the actus reus.
So why is this not just fine then?
Well, the actus reus, Your Honor, is maltreating somebody. And as the Supreme Court said, it's not just doing something, it's doing something that and that something is wrongful. So the mens rea applies to both those elements. But again, under Article 93, you don't have those two elements. And Judge Erdman, you mentioned there are two elements. There are, but what I meant by that is that what criminality turns on here is whether the conduct is maltreatment, whether it's abusive, whether it's likely to result in harmful or mental or physical harm. If it doesn't meet that requirement, it's not criminal. It's not unlawful to flirt with a subordinate. It's only unlawful under Article 93 to flirt with a subordinate if that flirtation is abusive and likely to cause mental or physical harm.
So the military context of this makes no difference in your analysis.
Well, I think it should be made very clear that things can be done differently in the military. We have fewer rights in the military because of the unique nature of the military. We do things different procedurally. But all this is about is statutory interpretation. The government is more than welcome to criminalize negligent maltreatment. But under Alanis and previous Supreme Court precedent, the way to do that is to have Congress make it explicitly clear that that's the intent of the statute. What the Supreme Court has said is that, absent that explicit intent, we are not going to read negligence or strict liability into a statute. That's what the government's asking to do here. They can still charge people under 93 and prove that an accused acted knowingly or perhaps recklessly, if that's what the court decides. And if it wants to criminalize negligent behavior, it can do so. It just needs to say, get Congress to say that's what the intent is behind the statute. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:15.